Salo Falava. I'm Afamasanga Seyuli Salamasina Von Reiki, and I'm inviting you to join me on a journey through the evolution of our Pacific cultures on Culture Compass. We'll meet incredible people dedicated to preserving traditions while adapting them for today's world. Join me as we travel the Pacific to celebrate our resilience, revival, and deep-rooted connection.
Search for Culture Compass wherever you get your podcasts to listen.
This is an ABC podcast.
Bon dia, ta aloha ni, ni sambulivinaka, and good follow morning. This is Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia. Aggie here, and today on the show, new statistics reveal nearly two women in Papua New Guinea are tortured or killed every day due to accusations of sorcery.
It's getting worse because it's a copycat crime. People have started to realize that they can do this and get away with it.
Also, a large Australian cotton producer is in court following the drowning death of a Ni Vanuatu worker. And we have weekend highlights from the OFC Pro League competition, with PNG club Hikari scoring their first win, defeating Vanuatu United.
I think the difference is the team spirit. We need to stay disciplined and now our time to show that we are improving.
All those stories are shortly, but as always, we like to give acknowledgement that our show comes to you from the lands of the Boonwurrung and Wurundjeri peoples of the Kulin Nation. I say ngā mihi. Thank you for tuning into Pacific Beat, yours in the Pacific. We begin with Papua New Guinea's Media Council, who is calling for a swift and independent police investigation after a journalist was allegedly assaulted by correctional service officers. The reporter from the national newspaper was attending a press conference at correctional service headquarters when she was confronted and assaulted, reportedly over a story about injuries to prisoners at the Bamana Correctional Facility. The journalist has since lodged a police complaint, and Prime Minister James Marape has called for a full investigation. So joining us this morning to discuss the incident is Neville Choi, President of the Media Council of Papua New Guinea. Then I say, good morning, Neville, and welcome to the show.
Good morning, Aggie. Glad to be here.
Always. Thank you very much for joining us this morning. I mean, Neville, this female reporter was allegedly punched and assaulted by five prison wardens. I'm wondering, what condition is she currently in?
She is okay. She was punched by the first attacker, a CS officer in CS uniform. And then she was she pushed him away, so she, in self-defense. And immediately after that, she returned to the office and filed a police report. So that is now on foot.
And Neville, what does this incident really, like, tell you? You know, as someone who was the head of the Media Council, yeah, what does it tell you about the state of press freedom in PNG?
Well, to speak on the state of press freedom in PNG, I mean, just having public servants lashing out at reporters over something that seems now to be bigger than what it initially was, I mean, that is just, that's not on. We can't have public servants and attacking reporters because they clearly probably have something to hide. Reporters are just doing their jobs, and they're reporting facts, and they're reporting on what the citizens should know and what government should know. And it's shameful for public servants to at the CS to lash out like that.
So then what does the Media Council themselves want to happen with the situation?
Well, she has filed a report, a police report, and we have, we understand that the RPNGC is looking at this seriously. And I think what the media probably needs is for public servants and the public in general, and persons in authority to realize the work of the media. I mean, we're not here to point fingers at anybody. We're here to report the facts and for our citizens to make more informed decisions, and for our authorities to pay attention to what may be happening that they don't know about.
Well, Neville, we understand police investigation has started, and you know the Prime Minister has voiced his support for an official probe. I want to know, why is it necessary for the council to also voice its position on this issue?
Well, over the past 3 or 4 years, there's been our national leaders have called for more work on improving the standard of journalism, etc. We from the council have tried to inform and educate our national leaders and our authorities in the country that we are a necessary part of democracy. Freedom of the press is extremely important to make sure that our citizens know what's going on and to make sure that our leaders know what our citizens' concerns are.
I mean, this is the other thing. I understand that, you know, citizens should be informed, right, of things like this that are happening. How should the process be then when it comes to an incident like this?
Well, if the council has set up and formalized the Independent Complaints Tribunal, and it's the industry's complaints management mechanism, and it's available there for anybody to use, from citizens to government. And if anybody has any issues about the way the media is working, then they have a formal process to follow. To lash out at journalists who are just doing their jobs is inexcusable.
Neville, are you aware that this is an isolated incident, or has this happened before?
I can't say it's an isolated incident. We have had threats against the media before. We have had journalists who have been attacked while they were practicing their craft. But there are, you'll see now with this case, that there's a lot of understanding, more understanding about the work of the media and the importance of the work of the media. And we'd like to make sure that this continues and this is acknowledged, not just by particular individuals, but by everyone.
And I would like to know then, what protections are in place for our female journalists, you know, when they're just out there having to do their jobs?
Well, our newsrooms are well aware of women journalists out in the field, so they have security protocols that they follow. And it's not just threats against women journalists. I mean, men journalists also face the same things. But I think the issue is how the understanding of how the media works. Many people or people in authority, and a clear case of this is the CS officers who attacked the journalist felt that she was at fault for highlighting or reporting something or reporting on information that was made available to all of the media and not just the national.
Neville, are you aware that there has been any, I do understand there's an investigation underway at the moment, but are you aware of any arrests since this incident had happened?
No, I am not aware of any arrests that have taken place since Saturday. I do know that the RPNG Police Commissioner has committed to ensure that there is an investigation that's going on. So we have the investigation into the Bomana prison incident. But the Commissioner of Police has also said that his team is looking at the incident of the assault.
Well, as always, Neville, thank you so much for keeping us across the latest as to what is happening there in PNG. But hopefully we can catch up again to the outcome of this.
Thank you, Aggie.
No worries. That is Neville Choi, President of the Media Council of Papua New Guinea here on Pacific Beat. Now, staying in PNG, nearly two women in the country are tortured or killed every day due to accusations of sorcery. This is according to the PNG Tribal Foundation, a local NGO that works to end sorcery violence in Papua New Guinea. Its president, Gary Buston, says since 2022, his organisation has supported more than 630 survivors, facilitated 149 arrests, and secured 14 successful prosecutions. Whenua Whenua spoke with Gary Buston.
It's getting worse because it's a copycat crime. People have started to realize that they can do this and get away with it. And that's why we wrote the law. In the areas where we're working and the arrests we're getting and all of that, the model is working and cases are reducing in those areas. And we work in several provinces across the country, but it's such a big job that we need all the support we can get. In PNG, about 3 or 4%, roughly, this is a rough number, of cases that are reported equal an arrest. Not an arrest, but a successful prosecution. So very few people are actually getting prosecuted. And that's the problem that we have. Because if you want somebody's land or you want retribution or political power, whatever it is, you can accuse someone of sorcery, get people riled up, and then you can get what you want. And up until the last few years, very few people were being held accountable for that. The justice system in PNG is not receiving the support that it needs. There's not enough police officers, there's not enough judges and magistrates. And so all of that is very challenging.
Have you met the perpetrators, and are they apologetic?
Yes, many.
Do they really believe that these women, their victims are sorcerers, or are they apologetic? Do they admit that they were taking advantage of them?
So it's a mixed bag. There's people that rile others up, and they know what they're doing. But then there's simple-minded people in the community that are just doing whatever they think they want to do, whatever they're told. And so there's a mixed bag of people that are either using the simple-minded people in the community, because in PNG, everyone has a base-level belief in sorcery. And with the breakdown of society, people don't really know what they believe. They just know that they believe in sorcery. So whatever story that comes across, you know, then it's believed. And so people use that to manipulate them. There's like the glass men and glass Marys that go around. It's their livelihood to get people accused. They come in the community and they get paid. And the reason why they do it is because that's how they make their living. So they go to a village and say, I have special powers. I can tell you who the sorcerer is if you pay me. So the community already has someone they want to be accused. So then they'll pay this glass man or glass Mary, and then they'll confirm, yes, it was that person. So they're kind of brought in as an authority, if you will. And their authority is always based on a gimmick. There was one woman in Chimbu Primary, and she said she had a little bumblebee that she made food. The bumblebee would tell her, you know, who was the sorcerer. We have a prayer warrior who said that Mary, the mother of Jesus, came and taught her how to pray, and she could see, you know, who the sorcerer was.
I've seen one video, and it's absolutely horrific. You have the community watching, and you hear the stories of torture, and it's a slow, painful death. So they're not just killing the person, but it's about ensuring that it's extremely painful. Could you describe that? Why is that, and how the community just gets involved in it?
Yeah, so there's a story that they've told, the Glassman and Glass Mary have told, that someone steals someone else's heart. And the sorcerer, if they steal their heart, if you torture the sorcerer enough, they can put the heart back. And so they're basically working off of that story, saying if we torture them enough and put them in enough pain, then we can get them to put the heart back in the person who's died. So it's, you know, it's ridiculous. And we've had a forensic pathologist even bring the people in and try to open the body of the deceased person and show that their heart was in there to the people that were making the accusations. And they still were like, well, they must have put the heart back just before you cut them open. You know, so there's a lot of folklore and just ridiculous belief associated with it. When you stop the accusation, then you stop the whole process. And we have a number of cases around the country now where we're able to stop the accusations in their tracks, where we just present the law, say we're watching you. So if anything happens from this case, you've already broken the law. So all we have to do is work with the police to come and arrest you, whether somebody's been hurt or not, because you've been doing the accusations. So it's really an effective system. And this is something that is new in the last, I would say, 15 years. It's really taken on the form that it has now. When I was growing up in the Highlands, we had witch doctors, but they were respected and they didn't go around accusing people of sorcery and people weren't being tortured like this. This is basically a relatively recent last 15 years phenomenon that's taken on across the country. And so holding people accountable will stop it, and making people aware of the law will stop it. So we need all the help we can get because there's new victims coming to us every day.
And that is PNG Tribal Foundation President Gary Buston.
What's up, ABC Radio Australia listeners? I'm Sosafina Fomoli, and I want you to come hang with me for On The Record, your weekly deep dive into the music that moves the Pacific. We'll talk about the big tracks that inspire your favourite Pacific music artists and the real stories behind them. Plus, we'll uncover some gems that you might not know yet, keeping the heart of the Pacific alive and thumping. Catch On The Record Mondays at 3 p.m. PNG time on ABC Radio Australia.
Obrigada. Thank you for joining in to Pacific Beat. Now, in Timor-Leste, the lawyer acting for a group from Myanmar who've lodged a complaint of war crimes at home says local prosecutors should not be pressured as they examine the case. Myanmar's military junta ordered Timor-Leste's top diplomat to leave the country after Timor's public prosecutor accepted a complaint lodged by members of Myanmar's ethnic Chin minority in January. The Timorese government initially condemned the diplomatic expulsion, but last week Prime Minister Xanana Gusma walked that back and even asked prosecutors to archive the case. The Chin representative's lawyer, Jose Tesares, says Timorese law allows for investigations into alleged human rights abuses overseas under the doctrine of universal criminal jurisdiction. And he says the public prosecutor should be left to assess the case free of political pressure.
It regards certain crimes, and particularly crimes against humanity, as being under universal jurisdiction because they are such compelling crimes, what is called jus cogens, and these are offences that concern the international community as a whole. Timor-Leste is, to its core, an international humanitarian and human rights treaty obliging state. We have ratified all of those conventions and treaties, and therefore we have an obligation, we think as lawyers, and our clients, the Chin Human Rights Organization and the victims and their families agree, that we have an obligation to prevent and punish such crimes. Domestically, Timor-Leste's criminal law also incorporates international crimes and recognizes international law as a source of legal authority. Constitutionally, the constitution of the RDTL, or the Democratic Republic of Timor-Leste, affirms also the respect for international law, for human rights and access to justice. We submitted on behalf of our clients that together these international statutory and constitutional foundations justify Timor-Leste in exercising universal jurisdiction, universal criminal jurisdiction, where other states fail to act to provide justice to the victims of these crimes, as is the case in Myanmar. Our own experience of mass international of crimes and enduring impunity, we believe, also gives us this moral imperative to advance the global accountability in keeping with those obligations I mentioned. Regardless of the merits of this case, what is important is that crimes of this nature offend the international community as a whole and must be shielded by any political or diplomatic inaction.
Several days ago, it's like Prime Minister make statement asking the prosecutor to archive these cases because maybe can give impact to the bilaterals between Myanmar and Timor-Leste. What do you think about this?
As a lawyer, as a practicing lawyer in the Timorese justice system, I know that the Timorese Public Prosecution Office, the Ministério Público, and the courts are independent under our legal system, and that they are actually very, very proud of that independence that they know they have. They need time to reflect in a non-politicized space on the best way to move forward, a way that is consistent with Timor-Leste's legal frameworks and true to our constitution and our national identity. I'm going to limit my comments to that.
So how Timorese law allows an investigation into war crimes in another country?
Of course, any investigations of this nature require the cooperation of other jurisdictions where the evidence is. Crimes are committed overseas, so the evidence must be gathered in other places. Now, in this case in Timor-Leste, we are arguing that universal criminal jurisdiction, as I've already described and outlined to you, gives as a result of Timor-Leste's international obligations and our legal and constitutional framework gives the Timor-Leste legal system the competence to receive international jurisdiction. Of course, it cannot enforce any processes required by itself. It will need to obtain evidence overseas. It will need to question these people. Well, there are international mechanisms, including mechanisms such as those that the government recently, I believe, approved, the ASEAN treaty, of various ASEAN treaties that are in play, that will permit for what's called judicial cooperation amongst states. So that's one way. The other way is that, I mean, if the question is asked, how do you gather all of this evidence? Well, there is a big international body that's been established under the UN, and it's called the Independent Investigative Mechanism for Myanmar. And it sits at The Hague. It is mandated to investigate international crimes and has done so in relation to Myanmar. And it is also mandated to share that evidence with national authorities. So there is plenty of support from those institutions, because they have also gathered evidence in relation to these types of crimes, of which the Chin people have brought a complaint in Timor-Leste.
And that is lawyer Jose Tashare speaking to our Timor-Leste reporter, Vonia Vieira.
Pacific Beat.
Right, now authorities in New South Wales have started court proceedings against a large cotton producer following the drowning death of a seasonal worker from Vanuatu. 30-year-old Moken Motsungtung died while working on the irrigation property at Karinda in northwestern New South Wales in 2024. Charges have been laid against Peter and Jane Harris and their six associated farming partnership companies and their farm worker son, Jack Harris. Leighton Moken's brother, Steve Motsungtung, said they are happy to see the court case happening soon and they are calling for justice. Mr. Motsungtung spoke with reporter Lea Loanbu about the ongoing case.
The case that is continuing now, especially for my late brother, late Moken Motsungtung. The court should be last week, so the 16th of February, but due to the defendant, the legal team, I think they are not ready. So the court order the case to be adjourned on the 20th of April, 2026. So we'll just wait, pray and hope that the proceeding of the case should be.
So as the late Morgan's brother, how are you feeling about this? And what is your family saying about the court case and the investigation?
The case about late Morgan, it's a sad incident that our family members, especially my dad, they are very sad to hear about the incident that happened to my late brother Moken. We hope and pray during the court hearing or court case, there should be a fair decision. Justice must be prevailed. That's what we are praying for.
So with the support of Safe Work, Ensure Justice, how does it make you feel that you're getting that support and there's, you know, ongoing work to get justice?
We are happy about Safe Work with this ongoing investigation. It was a big achievement and a big help for us, which they've completed the investigation and now they proceed to the court. Hopefully, we open pray that there should be an answer positively from the court hearing of this case. A reminder to our RSC workers that they are working in Australia or abroad. They have to make sure that safety should be a paramount to everyone. If there's any cases that the environment of working is not safe, they have to raise those issues to the authority concerns so that their safety will be more important, so that they won't face this kind of issue about my late brother Moken that he was facing now due to carelessness, and they don't have.
Have you gotten any details about the investigation, result of any investigation?
Actually, at the moment, yes, we have IFP deals, but it's confidential for just for myself and the Safe Works and other people who helped me out. It's still confidential, those information, and praying that everything should be at a safe hand of the court.
And that's it for Steve Maltungtung speaking with reporter Leah Lowenboo.
You're listening to Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia.
That's right, you are tuning in to Pacific Beat. It's Anna for Love. I'm your host, Agatha Wall, and it's time just for a quick recap on the stories we've shared so far. PNG Prime Minister has called for a full investigation after a journalist was allegedly assaulted by correctional service officers. Also, we had a story there on nearly two women in Papua New Guinea who are tortured or killed every day due to accusations of sorcery, and court proceedings against a large cotton producer following the drowning death of a seasonal worker from Vanuatu has begun. Still to come though, we've got our weekend highlights from the OFC Pro League competition, especially with PNG club Hikari scoring their first win, defeating Vanuatu United. All of that here on Pacific Beat, but right now, it's your news wrap. Yes, kia ora and welcome to News Wrap, where we head around the region to get the latest headlines. And we've got someone special in the studio with me this morning, one of our new producers. It is Dana Kirimoff, with that I say welcome to the show.
Hi, good morning, Aggie. Thank you so much. I'm excited to be here.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for coming and being part of the team. We welcome you so much, so thank you for being here. We've got a couple of stories that you brought up for us this morning. I believe over the weekend, the US and Israel launched joint bombing strikes against Iran, killing Iran's supreme leader Ayatollah al-Khamenei. Dana, I understand that there have been a number of reactions across the Pacific. Can you tell us what you know so far?
Yeah, so the Prime Minister of Papua New Guinea, James Marape, said that his government is monitoring the situation and is particularly paying attention to how this could impact global oil prices and is ready to step in with government subsidies should those oil prices take a hit. At the same time, Prime Minister Marape has stressed that long-term economic resilience depends on the strengthening of domestic food production and reducing reliance on imports. He said that in times like these, I strongly encourage Papua New Guineans to buy from local producers. We have enough food in our country. We do not need to be pressured into consuming imported food as our primary staple.
Wow. Dan, as we know, what's happening with the rest of the region, though?
Yeah, there's a little bit more. So in Vanuatu, like most of the globe, the government has issued advice for those planning to travel to or through the region to postpone all non-essential trips until the situation improves. And then finally, in Fiji, the government has not received confirmed reports of Fijian citizens being directly affected by the bombings, but they're aware that Fijian nationals do reside in the affected countries and around the Gulf.
Yeah, and we are hoping to see if we can speak to some of those Fijian nationals as to how they're feeling during this whole situation. So, yeah. Thank you for sharing that. Let's head over to Vanuatu, though, where the Ministry of Health has confirmed a fish poisoning outbreak. Goodness, what are the details here?
Yeah, so the ministry has confirmed an outbreak of Ciguatera fish poisoning across Vanuatu, with 44 cases reported from early January to mid-February of this year.
Wow.
Cases have been reported on a number of islands, but the majority of these have occurred on Afate. And then, so Ciguatera poisoning is an illness caused by eating tropical reef fish. And so the government has issued warnings to avoid eating reef fish just during this time until things get better.
Okay, thank you for that. Now we want to look at Tropical Cyclone Irma. Vanuatu has been given the all clear, but Fiji is now facing the storm. What's the updates here?
Yeah, so the Category 2 tropical cyclone is moving southeast and it's already exited Fijian waters, but Fiji has been hit with heavy rains and strong winds. They have caused major flooding and power outages across Fiji. The Ministry of Education has advised that all schools across Fiji will be closed today. They're going to continue to update communities on the reopening of schools, but that hasn't been confirmed just yet.
Nice, Dana. Thank you so much for bringing us our news wrap this morning here on Pacific Beat.
No worries. Thank you, Aggie. Good morning.
Want the latest Pacific Rugby League and Union news and interviews with stars of the game? Tune in to Nation Footy with Sam Wykes and Tinirau Arona.
Oh, you've been to PNG, eh?
We've got to make sure the listeners know that we love them as well.
So then when we go to the Cook Islands,
so Nation,
how do we get to the Cook Islands?
Bosses, anyone listening?
Nation Footy, Monday afternoons at 4 o'clock PNG time on ABC Radio Australia or wherever you get your podcasts.
Maloda mai bombongini, welcome back to Pacific Beat. Now to sports news. 4 years ago, Nicola Demain was coach of Papua New Guinea's national women's soccer team when they beat Fiji 2-1 to win the OFC Nations Cup for the first time ever. Coach Demain's reward was to be sacked in controversial circumstances, a move which triggered a long-running saga over the real reasons behind the PNG FA's decision to dispense with her services. Fast forward to January this year, and after a spell in charge of the national women's team in Bhutan, Nicola Demain returned to Oceania to lead Fiji in the OFC World Cup qualifying tournament. And after a 5-0 win in their opening match against New Caledonia on Friday, later today, Coach Demain and her coolers will be up against, of all teams, the PNG Bullums, in a match that is vital to both sides, and that comes with some added spice.
It's not ideal to have my second game in charge against Papua New Guinea, you know, because we do have that history, but just trying to look at it like any other game and preparing in the same way, you know, looking at strengths and weaknesses and what we can do to, you know, nullify and exploit those, and just treating it, you know, as professionally as I can, as I would in any other team that we play. But it's a must-win game for us, you know. I don't know what we're capable of yet, but anybody who's here would want to come top of the group and try to avoid New Zealand in the next round on the assumption they'll come top of theirs and then beat them in the final, right? So you qualify directly to the World Cup. That's the pathway that these girls have decided they want to take, that they can take. Somehow we got there in a few weeks, so we'll see what we can do.
Quite a number of the players that you will be facing in this match are players that you coached 4 years ago. And if I'm right, I think you've maintained relationships with them. You communicated with them while you were away coaching in Bhutan. So emotionally, it's going to be quite tricky, isn't it? I mean, you're going to be playing against players who I guess you consider to be your friends.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know how it's going to be. Hopefully it's not going to be something that affects me. It was an emotional time, and we were closest players and staff. I don't know if any of the staff are here from that time, but I saw Ramona Padio at the media conference, and it was lovely to see her. She told me she had another son, and, you know, we exchanged hugs on greeting. I don't think that will be how I greet the rest of the team on game day, but it'd be lovely to catch up with them after the game.
Just harking back to 4 years ago, you raised a lot of questions about the way you were treated with OFC and with FIFA. 4 years down the track, did you ever get any satisfactory answers? Did you ever get any answers at all?
I didn't get any answers at all. And, you know, if it were a few years ago, I don't know if I would have come back to Oceania to work, but that's in the past now. And these women need someone to come here who's got the sort of skill set and the passion to help them reach the next level. So when they offered me the job, it was easy to take it. You know, I said to the girls, the hardest games I've ever prepared teams for, the scariest opposition I've ever played is when I've played Fiji, you know, and now we're together and that's what we're doing. So let's show people how scary we can be. You know, there's such talent in the region. There's always been so much potential in Fiji, the athleticism of the players, the footballness of some of the regions, and the programs that they're doing and they've had in place for a number of years now compared to like Papua New Guinea, just put them in such a good place to be successful. And they just sort of needed this program to make that change, I think. Whether we'll see that change now, although I've had enough time, I'm not sure. But for sure, whatever the next competition is, we'll be looking to put new crowns on the Pacific Queen title.
And I'm wondering also, in terms of the qualification process, it seems to be stretched out this time by OFC. This is the second stage. There's a third stage still to come. Is that a good thing?
Having it different to the Nations Cup is getting more teams, more games. And that's the one thing that's really missing, I think, here. So that can only be a good thing. American Samoa obviously did well in the first stage and have used that time to put together a good squad for the second one. So that's making everything a bit more competitive. We were lucky to play them last week, so that was a good practice for us. I think that more games is good. I don't know if New Zealand would agree with that because it would affect their budget going forward, but I think more games is definitely good.
You mentioned American Samoa, of course, pulled off a shock result. They defeated the current OFC champions, the Solomon Islands, in their own backyard. The American Samoan team under Amanda Cromwell have now played 3-1-3. They're yet to concede a goal. You managed to beat them 2-1 in a friendly, but I'm guessing you must have been pretty surprised about the team you were playing compared to the reputation of the team that went before.
We had studied them from their two games that they had in stage one, and we knew they had a lot of really capable players all across the park. You know, they've got some really good fullbacks, and so that was brilliant for us. to play a game against, you know, such capable women was a really good test. And to get the win was just a little confidence booster there at the end.
It seems to me American Samoa have got a genuine chance of making it through to the next stage now, which is unprecedented for a nation that became famous when their men won their first ever World Cup game and they made a documentary about it.
It's the way of the world, I think. If you look at the men's World Cup, there are a lot of English men there who weren't playing for England, you know. This is just how it is. You know, FIFA allow you to have these diaspora players, and if it's a chance for them to represent their heritage, their mum's country, their dad's country, or their grandparents' country, it's awesome. Like, we had a number of them in the Samoa team, and they love to be able to be part of their culture, their history. And so I think that's sort of the way of football now. And we have two players in the Fiji team who are the same, and that's just how it's being done.
How confident are you going into the game against Papua New Guinea? How do you rate their current team?
I'm not sure how I rate my team yet, you know. I haven't really been here long enough to know what we're capable of and sort of understand where the region's at. But I think that there's every chance we could win the game.
Post-match reaction, should you beat Papua New Guinea? It'll be interesting to see how you go.
Yeah, so just sort of next job, just looking at the processes. Yeah, I don't know. I might feel differently after the game. Feel free to ask me.
And that's Nicola Demain, now coach of the Fiji Coolers and out to topple PNG, the side she led to their biggest ever success. And Nicola was talking to Richard Hewitt. Now, that match in Bar is in World Cup qualifying Group B, which will also feature Vanuatu taking on New Caledonia today. While in Group A over in Honiara, Solomon Islands meet New Zealand, and American Samoa can seal in historic place in the next round if they beat another of Nicola Demain's former teams, Samoa. Now, Papua New Guinea's club Hikari scored their first win of the OFC Pro League, defeating an in-form Vanuatu United in the third round of the competition. Hikari kept their composure to win 3-1 in a gritty match in front of a large delegation of Vanuatu supporters at the home of the Matildas in Melbourne. For Hikari coach Jerry Allen, he says his faith in the young team paid off as they overcame a gutsy Vanuatu team.
I think the difference is the team spirit. We've been talking because we showed that we have less supporters. Vanuatu and Samoa Island dominate the supporters, but we came here for a mission that at least we are searching for a win. So the boys stood up very well. They have this character of never say die, and today I'm really happy with them because at least we get a point. I said to them, stay disciplined, stay focused. The game is still on. We have another 45 minutes plus injury time. We need to stay disciplined, and now our time to show that we are improving. And yeah, today I think they step up really well.
And Vanuatu United coach Lars Hopp says despite winning earlier in the week against Buller FC and the Solomon Kings, they just couldn't muster the strength to shut Hikari down.
Yeah, I think in general this fits it quite well. I think it also goes to show that sometimes it's harder to deal with success than with defeat, because when you lose or you don't win, then everybody knows we need to improve. And maybe a little bit of this, a little bit too satisfied with our two previous performances, which doesn't give you anything on the day. And we know how it feels to chase your first win, so for sure Hikari, they gave it all they had. They defended with everything they had and used every method, which is fine, you know, because that's what we would do in the same situation. So we just got to take our learnings from that. I think in the first half we were not direct enough. We were not asking enough questions. Maybe slowing down our game to their pace, it's a different situation when you're the team that's, you know, kind of the favorite maybe or supposed to win. It's a different role, so it's I think part of the learning experience for our group, but we'll take our learnings from it and come back stronger.
And that there was Lars Hopp, Vanuatu United coach, speaking there following his side's surprise loss to Hikari. And meanwhile, Solomon Kings coach Ben Khan celebrated his birthday in style with a 2-0 win against a determined Buller FC in the second OFC Pro League game in the weekend. It was a match dogged by long delays due to a video-assisted referee stops, and there were plenty of yellow cards for both sides. Solomon Kings goalkeeper Philip Mungo was in superb form and pulled off some near-impossible saves to keep the Fijians scoreless. Kings coach Ben Khan says a massive turnout of support helped lift the team's spirit and pushed keeper Philip Mungo into overdrive.
Yeah, he's an amazing leader. He's an amazing man. He's an amazing goalkeeper. He saved us on numerous occasions, and obviously he took the knock to the jaw. And you know, we were preparing to make the sub. We were told he was coming off. So for him to get up and bounce back and make two or three big saves, and it wasn't just the saves he made. You know, it was the way he managed the game as well and helped the other boys through it. He's outstanding, and we're very lucky to have him.
Meanwhile, Buller FC coach Stephanie Alvre says he tried to use a mix of fresh talent and experience to secure a win against the Solomon side.
We wanted our young players to have a taste of playing, because some of them never played. And then we wanted the players young or more experienced to come in second half and finish the job. We were pretty close to achieving this. But you know, football is unpredictable, so I will really stick to all the good things we've done. And I want the players to do it as well, because it's been 2 months and a half. So let's speak about it and later on.
But it wasn't to be, with Buller FC going down 2-0 to the Kings in front of a sea of Solomon Islands supporters. No doubt a preview of the crowd size and passion to come when the Pro League rolls into Honiara for the next leg of the tournament. One man familiar with playing in Solomon Islands is Buller FC captain Roy Krishna. Now, the last time he played there, he joined us on a Pacific Games broadcast out of Honiara. The Fijian international told Pacific Beat's Evan Wasuka he's looking forward to meeting up with some old club teammates when he's back in the Happy Isles. But first, here's Roy Krishna reflecting on his side's loss to the Solomon Kings.
We need to score. We had so many chances. We knew we are a team that create a lot of chances, and it was a matter of scoring goals. And we should have buried the first two, we didn't, and then they scored, and then we started chasing the game. But yeah, we just need to score first, and then the game will be in our hands.
Buller FC came on really strong in the second half. Like for a while there, it looked like you guys had the upper hand. What do you think didn't happen?
Didn't happen, of course, to score goals, but whoever started today, I'm just proud of them, because everyone deserved to start. And, the second half, we did the mentality change in a few subs, and then we just needed to win for the team. End of the day, we lost. We all take the responsibility and move forward. Tomorrow, we regroup and we go again.
This is the third round here in Melbourne. How has the team been going through the first round in New Zealand, PNG, now here? What's your assessment of the team?
We're improving. Of course, we are a young team, a lot to learn from. But the boys are getting there. Of course, the weather is very cold for most of the boys, but no excuses, For us, we are just privileged and honored to play professional football. And these young boys, I just tell them, just enjoy this moment. And, if you can really focus on your little bits, which is discipline, how you look after yourself off the field, and then you can go further. So, yeah, that's the key message, but I'm just proud of the boys.
For the next round in Honiara, you won't have to worry about the cold. I think we spoke to you the last time you were there on ABC. Yeah. Are you looking forward to heading back to Honiara?
Yes. I think, whenever I go to Solis, I played with some of the legends of Solomon stars, likes of late Comments Manapi, Benjamin Totori. So, yeah, I know they're very close to me. And whenever we go there, we have them as our 12th men. So, we're not playing Solomon Kings this time, but we're playing some other teams, and hopefully they can come and support us. So looking forward to meet the family.
Yes, I remember the last time you were there, lots of fans out. You are very popular out there. I'm just wondering, how are your boys handling the new type of league? Because it's day in, day out playing. You're used to it. You've come from India and before that A-League. How is the rest of the boys coping with this new type of setup?
Well, it's hard because we play after every 3 days. Obviously in this round we're playing 4 games. We know we have a big group, but end of the day we need every little bit of recovery we can, to play the next game. But look, this is what it is. We are just happy that we are playing professional football. And hopefully in the future, maybe, something can change and then we can have at least 4 or 5 days off. But look, we're just happy that the professional football is in Oceania, and it's good for not just Fiji people, the whole of Oceania, young kids to pursue their career in professional football.
And that is Buller FC captain Roy Krishna speaking there to Evan Wasuka about the next stage of the Pro League tournament. And that brings us to the end of Pacific Beat. Time to take a look back at one of our main stories today. Papua New Guinea's Media Council President Neville Choi is calling for a swift and independent police investigation after a journalist was allegedly assaulted by correctional service officers.
We can't have public servants and attacking reporters because they clearly probably have something to hide. Reporters are just doing their jobs and they're reporting facts and they're reporting on what the citizens should know and what government should know.
And that's PNG's Media Council President Neville Choi. You can find those top stories when you type Pacific Beat or Radio Australia into your search engine. Remember to check out our socials too on Facebook and Instagram by clicking on ABC Pacific. Our team will be back same time tomorrow at 6 a.m. PNG time, but you can always hear us again this afternoon at 5 p.m. PNG time. Stay tuned to ABC Radio Australia though, because your news is next, and coming up after that, it's Leisure Daily. So until next time, o tua o whātou. This is Pacific Beat, yours in the Pacific.